Kevin Donnelly, a 6'5", 305-pound guard, arrived in Miami with a reputation for being tough, physical, and maybe a little bit nasty. But blocking for Dan Marino is a different kind of gut check.
To me, Jimmy Johnson, Dan Marino, the defense that they had built, the wide receivers with OJ, it was just an amazing, I think, fulfillment of like, okay, now I can go somewhere that's going to get some wins. But, you know, I got in that huddle for the very first time, and I'm like, I've been working out. I've been doing mini camps, training camp, all that deal, and it's game one, and I'm like, oh, my God. If anyone gets past me to that man, number 13 back there, I won't be allowed in the state. I might not be allowed in the southeast. Certainly nowhere near Pittsburgh, where they love them up in Pennsylvania. I was like,
ever again.
It was. I was like, man. Can I not? Can I go back?
I'm OJ McDuffie, the 1998 National Football League's receptions leader.
And I'm Seth Levitt, a former member of the Miami Dolphins media relations department. And in today's episode of The Fish Tank, Donnelly digs deep into his old journals to share outrageous stories from his Dolphins days.
Hey, DJ Preach.
Tell them what time it is.
You're now diving into the fish tank.
Dive up in that fish tank. Who that? Sitting down with Seth Living. Seth. OJ. Juice man. Ooh, and this is strictly for them true fans. Yeah. Dolphins. Number one. Of course, y'all. This ain't no ordinary sports talk. Dive up in that fish tank.
Welcome back to the Fish Tank right here on the Miami Dolphins Podcast Network. Seth Levitt and my main man, OJ McDuffie. Juice, today's a special day because we've got two guys, not one, but two guys that were responsible for the Miami Dolphins' last playoff victory. I just wish it wasn't, you know, quite as long ago. But Kevin Donnelly dives into the fish tank. Kevin, how you feeling today?
Oh, fantastic. So glad you guys had me on. I got tons of respect for you guys and have listened to the podcast that you put out. It's just been great. So I'm glad to be here. But listen, this is going to be some fun. We're going back a few years, but there's going to be some things that some Dolphin fans remember that I'm looking forward to sharing.
Well, so you talk about remembering. Here's what's really cool, Juice. So Kevin and I did a pre-interview, which I should have just pressed record because he gave me about an hour of his time. So I think we're on a running clock right now. But you mentioned that you started journaling when you got to Miami. You didn't do it for all the years, and we're going to talk about where you came from and everything, but all the years in Houston. But when you got to Miami, you started journaling. So we're anticipating a pretty clear memory here in some good sports.
Yeah, and you know, there may be some stories. You know, heck, I might have got them wrong because if a bunch of people say it some other way, but I did write them down. I got quote marks in there. Like when something was funny, something was going on, I put the quote marks down. That's as good as gold. But I realized when I was at the Houston Oilers and playing with that team and getting to play with Warren Moon and Steve McNair, Eddie George, Bruce Matthews, Mike Munchak, you know, Hall of Fame guys. And I got to the Dolphins, and now I was going to in charge of helping keep Dan Marino safe. I'm like, you know, this is something my kids that they're, you know, only had one at the time and one brand new newborn, or my wife was 9 months pregnant. But I just thought, you know, they're never really going to experience some of this stuff, and I'm going to forget so many things along the way. So I said, well, I'm just going to start keeping a journal. So I kind of, you know, titled at the beginning for my kids and family to enjoy some of my memories from when I played.
Well, you say you might have got it wrong. Right now, it's as accurate as anything that's ever been on this show because you at least wrote something down. Everybody else is full of shit,
that's
Kevin.
Right. So, hey, I'm holding it up like this is my co-signer of these books that I'm holding up right now.
I love it. It's going to be hard to argue with
and
that.
I tell you what, going through them, that 99 season, I believe, man, there was a ton of stuff just because we had so many characters on the team.
Oh, we're going to tee you up. We got a lot of
Yeah, we can't
questions.
Wait to get into 99. That's when we're, you know, like Prince, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Get it in. You know, Kevin, you mentioned, you know, I was blessed to play with you for 3 years. And, you know, we 3 years in the same huddle, man. But you talk about going back to those Houston Oilers days.
That's right.
You know what I mean? It's not the Texans. It's not the Titans. You know, those are all kind of the same branch of family there. But the Houston Oilers days, man. And your first 7 years there, you know, 91 and 97. And, you know, what I remember most about, like you talked about from those Oilers days, was that you had to protect not one, but two. We talked about the second one a little bit, but Warren Moon. Mm-hmm. You had to protect Warren Moon, a Hall of Famer, man. Tell us a little bit about Warren Moon, if you have any great stories. And, of course, we got to talk about the other Hall of Famer you just talked about protecting, Dan Marino.
Yeah, well, Warren Moon was just absolutely smooth. You know, he wasn't the most vocal guy, but he was had such an air and a confidence about him. And he's brilliant. You know, he really knows and understands defenses. And at that time, and OJ, you would have loved this. We ran the run and shoot. And so there was four receivers minimum on the field at all times. That's a four. That's our standard formation. And then a lot of times we'd even go five wide. And to even hammer it home even more, the tight end position and fullback position didn't even exist on our team. Like there was no just in case on goal line. Like we threw a tight end or a, you know, some other big lineman in there. My rookie year, I was a tight end. Like I'm like, throw me a bone, throw me one ball, give me something. But I'm out there blocking, doing deuce blocks and going up to the backers. And I got all of the bad parts of being the tight end. I never got any of the love, but that's how the roster was. And so pass blocking was a premium. And listen, I came from North Carolina and we predominantly ran the ball. You know, my senior season, we had Natron Means, who actually went to the league and was an absolute stud for the Chargers. And I loved blocking for that guy, but we didn't do a lot of pass blocking. So I got indoctrinated to it real quick. And fortunately, one of the best things, you know, if anyone's young listening, to be able to just watch somebody that's great at that position and be able to understand the position, learn from them and learn what they're like off the field. And I had a couple of guys, Bruce Matthews and Mike Munchak, who went on to be in Hall of Fame, but were fantastic offensive linemen, fantastic men, and were great with their families. And the role model that I was able to I didn't tell them at the time, but I told my future wife at the time, I was like, I'm just watching them, whatever they do, I'm going to do it. And so that helped me slowly be able to get into the starting lineup and work my way in the career. But blocking for Warren Moon was fun. He could, he was just great accuracy, great precision, great everything that he did. So it was just, it was a pleasure to work for him, but it was a ton of pressure. Now don't get Warren hurt. And I felt that too when I entered the huddle that first time when I was down in Miami. Like that was that, oh shit moment. Like, okay, I signed here. I want to play here. There'd been so much turmoil with the Oilers at that time because are they moving to Tennessee? Are they not moving? Then we decide to move. It's permanent. We're doing it. But we still have to play a year in Houston before we can even go up there. We're playing in front of 5,000 fans. It was just the weird stuff going on. I was like, I want to go to a contender. I want to go someplace where I can absolutely get some stuff done. And to me, Jimmy Johnson, Dan Marino, the defense that they had built, the wide receivers with OJ, it was just an amazing, I think, fulfillment of like, okay, now I can go somewhere that's going to get some wins. And that was a lot of big reason why I left there. But, I got in that huddle for the very first time, and I'm like, I've been working out. I've been doing mini camps, training camp, all that deal, and it's game one. And I'm like, oh, my God, if anyone gets past me to that man number 13 back there, I won't be allowed in the state. I might not be allowed in the Southeast. Certainly nowhere near Pittsburgh, where they love them up in Pennsylvania. I was like,
ever again.
It was. I was like, man, can I go back? Can I go back to Tennessee? But no, it worked out, and I was glad we got three playoff games that season. It was exactly what I was looking for. I hadn't been to playoffs in a while, and I get down there with OJ and the fellas on offense, and that defense was balling, and we were able to get there, and that gives you a chance.
You know what's so crazy about that, Kevin, is like you talk about a guy yourself that had been in the league for a while, and you still felt that pressure when you got another Hall of Famer, behind you. You know what I mean? Because a lot of times, you're the vet. I know Danny's a vet too, but hell, you're a vet as well. But that pressure is still there no matter what when you got one trade behind us.
Yeah, and I think the guys that do really well in the NFL and last for a while are guys that really, they feel that anxiety every single game. Like someone's hunting for their job. They could be cut at any minute that, you feel that you have to be at your best every single game. And whether you feel like it, your body feels like crap, or, the game plan was particularly difficult that week, whatever it is, you're still feeling that pressure. And the one thing I can tell you, but Bruce Matthews played 19 years in the league, is in the Hall of Fame, an absolute stud. And I remember asking him on about year 13, I'm getting nervous, maybe starting my first game or something like that. And I'm like, God, it must be nice to be you, man. You've got all these years in. This is just like, got to be another Sunday for you. And he's like, oh, no. Because every play I'm out there, guys drop off all of a sudden and they decide to retire or get cut. He's like, every day it's like I'm playing the first play in the NFL. It's just I'm that nervous about it. So it kind of put a sigh. Like I was like, oh man, is this what I got to look forward to every Sunday? But at the same time, he put me in a place. I'm like, okay, I get it, right? This is the job we picked. This is what we're blessed to do. So many guys want to be here, and that's just part of dealing with the job. And so, it, you know, you just deal with it. But, yeah, you know, I had – you know, people don't understand the offensive line. We're the only position that has someone's health in their hands. You know, we have their livelihood in their hands, and you never want to see the crew come out there with a cart, you know, and quarterbacks laying there, giving the fist to the crowd saying, hey, I'm going to be okay. But you're like, oh my God, they're going to replay this highlight. And Kevin Donnelly all over the place, letting somebody right. walk through there, Warren Sapp or someone, he's doing some sack dance. And so the fear of that is what drove me every single game to do my best.
You know, Kevin, we also had that pressure too. Now, if I've got a guy hot off the edge, you know what I mean, could be running blindsided. Yeah. If I don't break that shit hot, boy, I could be a lot of trouble myself, you know. But not like you guys, every single passing play, you got that, you had that pressure.
No, I get it. It all works together because you guys get open. You do exactly what you're supposed to do. That ball comes out quick, especially with Danny. I mean, his release, I'll tell you, I'm not too proud to say there's times where I whiffed, you know, and I got beat, and I look back. And Dan's standing there with his arms beside him, you know, like, I didn't know where the ball went. Like, he got it, threw it, and it was gone so fast. Sometimes I didn't even get a minus on that block from the offensive line coach, you know, because it was a great play came out of it. Something happened real quick, and I was thankful for that. Because there's, no matter what, this is a sport that no one plays the perfect game. And you got to be mentally tough that, you know, that happens. You don't let it carry over to the next play. Same with Juice there. I mean, you drop a pass, you better go find a way to get the next seven catches, and then suddenly it's a good day. You just can't dwell on it. But, man, there's some times, man, Dan helped me out big time. That release was like none other.
I was gonna ask you about the, you know, we're talking a little bit of 99 and, you know, the Reno stuff, and you know, we're talking about that comeback, you know, versus Indy, you know, right at the top of, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the comeback in Indy was one of my favorite times with Danny. We touched on how the 99 season was so impressive for a lot of things going on, but that comeback game against Indy was pretty impressive.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, when you had him back there, you always knew you had a shot. You know, if there's, you know, one of the greatest of all time and great in the fourth quarter and game-winning drive, so that gives you a lot of confidence as an offensive line. And, you know, you put a game plan in, everything's working well. You expect to stick with that game plan and what's been successful for you. But, you know, Seth and I discussed this before we got on this podcast. It was one of those moments I'd never been around in my entire career where he had so much weight and authority and no one would question him. And we're 4th and 10. I don't know where we are on the field, but we're trying to get down there. And if we don't get it, we're done. We lose. And it's 4th and 10, and the play comes in from the coordinator, Kippy Brown. And the first thing I hear is, Dan's like, F this, you know, we're not running this. This is what we're doing. I don't know if OJ remembers it, but like, that's all I heard. And the next thing I'm thinking, okay, if that's not the play, you know, okay, what are we going to do blocking wise? And he takes the time that we have to really work out what he's going to do with the receivers. And he's communicated with OG, Aronde Gadsden, and said, you know, do this or this different. And, you know, he wasn't the fastest guy. So we kind of did a little trick him on him, a little slant and go instead of the traditional slant that usually it was his bread and butter, right, OJ? I mean, that he wasn't going deep. He wasn't going deep.
No.
But, man, it was a great play, and he still could not run anybody. He got caught before he got to the end zone. But the funniest thing about it, the reason I paid attention to it so much, and it's been such a fond memory of mine, was when he said that to the play and just go ahead and change it right there on the spot. We got a few seconds to get this snap off, and we're going to the line of scrimmage. I'm like, Dan, what's the protection? What do you want? And basically – he's like, y'all do whatever the hell y'all need to do. All I need is a couple of speed bumps up there. I'm getting rid of the ball. Like, you know, I felt like, okay, cool. We'll take ownership for this. But at the same time, like, we got no control right now. We'll call something, hope it works. But the backhanded, you know, kind of part of that was like, we weren't really that needed on that play. The five linemen could have just dove to the ground, you know, just curled up like a ball. He just needed someone to just slow him down for just a half step, and he was getting the ball off. And he did. It worked out great. The protection was fine. But I just, you know, I'm a guy that works. I watch film. I want to know everything ahead of time because I wasn't the most gifted offensive lineman. I had to work and scratch and fight for everything I got. And suddenly you're telling me, just go ball? Hey, just ball. Just get it done. Just get it done. I'm like, I don't work that way, man. Like, this, I need to know. I need a plan. What is the play? But we got it done. We won the game. I mean, so it was all fun in the locker room afterwards. But it was, that was one of those moments. I, I'm like, man, I've seen it all now, man. I just saw him override everything. He just tapped into that like 16 years of experience and said, no, I know better. This is my show right now. We're going to go win this.
And it was. So fourth and 10, you guys were at the 50. There's a minute and four, I think, left on the clock, Juice. Like a minute and four. So you're right. That's it, Kevin, because that's, you know, take a knee and they're done. We are there. That dome would have exploded.
On the road, yeah, on the road.
You know. If you don't figure it out, Kevin, and there's a big sack, right? All that stuff happens. Oh. And Aronde, 48 yards. Yep. But you're right. He got stopped at the two and made up for it by catching the 2-yard touchdown to win the thing two plays later. But what an amazing comeback. I love that. Juice, so how many times did you hear him just F that and change the story?
Dude, a lot of times, man. A lot of times. But, you know, unlike what Kevin's talking about, though, a lot of times at least he went to a protection. He might say, like, I don't know, give him protection at least. You know what I mean? But when you don't have the protection and you just call something off the cuff like he did sometimes, at least we early offense, Kimby's offense is a little different than what we had before that. Before that, you know, we'd have a 90 series, a 70 series. So you could say, you know, tell the line, tell Kevin, all right, 70 protection, 90 protection. And then we can do whatever on the outside.
Yeah.
But when you don't give, you're used to just telling the route, F that, Aronde, you do this. Or, then you got to be like, well, shit, what's the protection? Is it 5-step, 3-step? Is it, you know what I mean? Is it 7-step? Yeah. What is this? What's going on here? So I get where he's coming from.
Well, now, I think Dan knew he was going to him. So he didn't really care about anybody else. And he knew the ball would be gone quick. So I wish I had thought of that at the time. Like, okay, we're all cool here. But there was 3 seconds of pure panic, wondering if this is really going to work out.
And you know what else, Kevin? I mean, we're in hurry up. Hurry up's always pure panic.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Everything is like running through your mind, you know. And of course, defense is going to bring some stuff, you know, that are going to try to, you know, take you off tilt, some blitzes, some over, whatever it might be. So the panic is always there in 2 minutes. But this dude was like, look. We're good. I can't even imagine what the play that was called, Kevin, that he overrode, you know. Well, I can't imagine what the hell it was, you know.
Well, I knew.
It wasn't as good as that one.
I'm sure I knew inside out what the play was supposed to be that was called by Kippy Brown. I was all over that play. This, man, I was flying blind.
Oh, that's so good. That is so good. So that's what the transition from Warren Moon to Dan Marino was like. But you also had a couple of big personalities as head coaches. So talk about the transition of going from Jeff Fisher to Jimmy Johnson, because those are also two different dudes.
Oh, completely. You know, and both won a bunch of games. You know, obviously, JJ had incredible success, both in college and in the pros with winning Super Bowls. But, you know, Jeff Fisher was very much a player's coach, and he really seemed to have the pulse of the team. He was always, you know, kind of knew what was going on with guys, when they needed a break, when they needed to be pushed. And I think, you know, someone that played in the league, played on that Bears defense and was around them, you know, that was his forte. But yeah, it was very much a lot more relaxed personality, but could find ways to motivate players and get the best out of them. Now with Jimmy Johnson, OJ, we all know, like the world knows that dude, man, he keeps his thumb on you all the time. And it's, you never felt like your job was safe, but there were clear, you know, visions and goals that he had for this team. And I always felt like, you know, as much as I felt like any day you could get cut, because it was kind of the world you live in, basically you produce, you're on the roster. You do not have to worry about some of that stuff. Just produce, just do your job, do it the very best you can. You know, you start to worry when you're counting roster spots and you're making mistakes and you're giving up sacks or anything like that. That's, you know, that's when the real worry comes in. But, man, if you're producing, I mean, Jimmy put his arm around, he loved you. He'd love on you as much as possible. But there's times where and he could be fun. Like, I know a lot of people say things about Coach Johnson, how tough he could be. But I don't know if OJ remembers this, but I'm sure you do. But it was during that 99 season, and that was when J.J. Johnson, the running back, got in a fight with Kevin Gogan. And they had fisticuffs. J.J. was a young player.
It was like a walkthrough.
Okay, I'll set the stage here. Right, it's a walkthrough before an upcoming game, so it's got to be a Friday, maybe even a Saturday light walkthrough. Like, we're just going through the motions just to do it. And, you know, J.J.'s anxious. He's a young player. He's getting in there. He wants to make sure his assignments are right. So he's being – you know, kind of full speed through this when everyone else is kind of going 70% and, you know, hit Gogan a couple times and bumped into him. And so they kind of exchanged words. And then Really felt JJ said something to him that, that Gogan felt disrespected, and you know, you don't disrespect Gogan now, like that's because he'll target you from then on for a long time in the locker room, making fun of you. It's gonna make your life hell. But they got into a fight right there in the middle of walkthrough, you know, day before a game. So it's just this crazy scene. And I bring it up because the after effects of it, you know, Coach Johnson dressed us down in a meeting saying, I can't believe this happened. He did it with the offense first. And I think the whole team, like, we can't have this kind of stuff going on. We need to be close. We need to be together. You know, player-led teams are the ones that just, they're the ones that are going to win and get through tough times and all that. And I'm not sure, if memory serves, I got the journal here. But I'm thinking we might have gone to play Oakland or something after that week. But JJ, this is fun. JJ Johnson rushed for 80 yards and on 20 carries. And JJ said, you know, game ball that we always do in the meeting after a win. He's giving out game balls for the guys that really perform well. He gave one to JJ Johnson. Then he made Kevin Gogan go up there and give it to JJ Johnson. It was uncomfortable, right, for a minute. And he's sitting there. He makes him give him the game ball. Then the whole team in the auditorium just starts screaming out, hug, 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 hug. So they were both reluctant. But it's like the whole team's yelling for it, and they hugged it out, you know. And I think things were pretty good after that. But that to me, I was like, those are the memories. It slipped my mind. I was going through the journal, like I mentioned, I keep, and I saw that, just that hug, 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 and everybody laughed. It was fun, and it really diffused the situation. It was brilliant by Coach Johnson. You know, it's one thing to give a game ball, but then to use that moment to bring everybody back together, make sure there was nothing, you know, lasting effects from that. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, and that's how we, you know, you really had to treat it in the locker room, man. You know, you can't let anything like that fester, man. It'll destroy a whole locker room for forever, man. So, and then at that point, somebody's got to go. So I'm glad they hugged it out, right, Kevin?
That's right. No, because they're good. I mean, they're both really good players, you know, and they're both guys that earned a lot of respect in that locker room. So it's when you've got two guys that possibly might have a beef, that being for them to work it out, you're right. Harmony above all, you know, there's going to be disagreements, but you got to keep harmony and keep the team goal in mind.
Yeah, no doubt. You know, Kevin, another guy you came across at Houston who would later meet up with back again in Miami was offensive line coach Larry Becker.
Oh yeah.
Now I'm sure you know most O-line coaches, they're notoriously, they're characters. They are definitely characters, and Beck had to be one of the all-time great characters, you know, of all time in the league's ever seen.
Yeah.
From what I understand, even though Beck only coached you for like a season in Houston, he came looking for you.
Yeah.
You know, he came looking for you when you were free agent in '98. So I'd love to hear that story. How'd that go down with him coming to find you, and also, I heard you do a hell of a Larry Bechtel impersonation, so I need all that information from you, Kevin.
Okay, well, listen, you know, when Larry Bechtel came to Houston, it was a good time. I was trying to really go from being a guy that was playing the NFL and trying to excel and become a player that, you know, that I wanted to be. And he was such a master of teaching technique, assignment football. It was great to have this guy that basically, you know, everyone has this assignment on every play. And when things adjust, this is what adjusts. If you studied your playbook, you knew what to do. And there wasn't a lot of gray area. And gray area is the worst part for an offensive lineman because it just makes you hesitate. It's not any position. You have to hesitate to process by just 0.1 of a second. It can mean the difference in, you know, having a dominating block and giving up a sack. So it's, I really appreciated that. And he was hard. I mean, he was hard on me, but he also, you know, at the same time, it's everyone always goes back. And those are the guys you want to thank as coaches, you know, the ones that were the hardest on you and really pushed you to be the best you could be. And so when I was a free agent and, you know, after going all that stuff with the Oilers and having to move the team to Nashville, and I just was like, you know what, I can be reunited with this great staff, with Coach Bechtel. I want to be there. So I was all in, you know. I had other trips planned as a free agent, but, you know, went there first because I wanted it to be the right fit, and it really was for me. It was great. But Big Beck, when you tell a story about Big Beck, you have to preface it by, you know, he was a smoker, and so obviously couldn't do that around the team at all. So he'd come in at every meeting and had like not just one nicotine patch, but like a nicotine patch on each arm, probably one on his neck. Plus he had two or three of the like nicotine gums going at all times. So he's chewing on it the whole time. He's got his glasses down. Hey, it's Big Beck hair, babe. All right, go. We do these chair drills, and he's making everybody sit in chairs, like starting offensive lines in a chair, the second team offensive line's in a chair, and then he kind of lines up some chairs at the defense, and to save our legs, he'd let us sit down, but he's like, I want to see your first two steps. First two steps, babe. All right, right here. And he could spot, he's like, the guy that's third team offensive left tackle, he took one wrong step when he's like, sit hut, and he does the two steps. He take it, he kind of paused, and he's like, the fuck's going on back there? That didn't look right. Tell me your step. Show me your step again. He could see all. He knew all. He's nicotined up. It just, it was always on for him. And plus, you combine that with the waddle. He's kind of waddling around. He's got double knee sleeves on, baggy shorts, baggy shirt. It just, he was a character. But, man, he really was one of the coaches I look at and really made a difference in my career, point two. I have nothing but the utmost respect for him. He was amazing for me, and I like my time with him. But, man, you know, I'll tell you one story. It's not a Dolphin story, but I was with the Houston Oilers, and we stayed in a dorm for training camp at San Antonio. That's where we always do our training camp. And we're out there, and he's coming through the dorm, and it's getting close to cut day. And so a guy I played with for several years, John Flannery, he's in the suite next to me. We shared a bathroom, and then I'm in the next room. But we could always hear what's going on, and we'd always tell each other, hey, it's time to get up. Let's go to breakfast. We always looked out for each other. But I'm getting ready, and all of a sudden I hear a knock, and I'm like, oh, my gosh. Like, is that at my door? Is that my door? And I hear another knock. And I'm like, it doesn't sound like it. I think it's John's door. Then there's the third knock. He's like, hey, John, Flannery, you in there? You in there? Flannery had been around enough. First words out of his mouth, he's like, hey, John Flannery, you in there? What's going on? All I hear is, ah, fuck. So Beck says, I know, babe. Big Beck here. Let me in. And then I left. I knew he got the speech. He's getting cut. It's not funny, but it's funny. Like,
right.
And right. We actually signed the guy back after a while because some guys got injured. So it worked out great for everybody's happy again. It's all good. It all worked out. And Flannery went on to be an important player for us with that Houston Oilers team. But like that, just in a nutshell, summed up Beck right there. You know, he's like, he breaks some bad news, but somehow it made it funny to me. I'm laughing. OJ knows I immediately took it. Like, once things had settled down, and maybe even after we signed Flannery back, I brought it up in the locker room, and like everyone wanted me to tell the story all the time. Tell about it when he knocked on the door. Tell it again. Come on now. Big Beck here, babe. Big Beck.
Oh, man. He loved to call himself Big Beck. I also loved in practice, like in 2-minute drill or something, if the offense scored, he'd start marching, singing the band. Do you ever hear it? Dun, 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 dun. He would sing the fight song.
I'll tell you, here's a story. God, that guy is something my else. Dolphin career with the Houston Oilers. So in Houston, after every time that we'd score, they play this song that would absolutely drive me crazy. Houston's got the Oilers, the greatest football team. We run and pass and score like no one's ever seen. And one of the small things I thought about when I left the Oilers to go to the Dolphins, I was like, man, I'm done with that song.
No, you're not, buddy.
No, you're not, buddy.
I have no idea. First game at home, you know, probably some 70-yard bomb to OJ, and instead of celebrating, all I can think of is like, and my wife said the same thing. She's in the stands watching. We talked about it after the game. Miami's got the Dolphins, the greatest football team. And I'm like, how do two towns have the same song? Who had it first? What's going on? This is not happening right now. This, where am I, man?
Oh, I love it. I hope you found out. So the Dolphins had it first.
Right.
Well, they weren't giving it up.
For you, it was Houston first. Oh, man. Yeah, there's some fan wars on that, but it definitely was the Dolphins song first. I don't think the guy who wrote it got the I don't think he was commissioned or got the royalties that he was hoping for. So he went down the block and sold it to your Oilers. Yeah. So you got it. You got the double dip. Oh, that's hilarious. Can you imagine that, Juice? So we just scored, everybody celebrating. And Kevin's looking around like, what the? Oh, that's
a – there's got to be a joke.
Am I back in
Houston? It's a joke, man. Someone's playing a prank on me.
That's
hey, this would be funny.
too good. Well, listen, if we're talking about Larry's, there's another one we have to bring up. And as you said, we had a great conversation in preparation for this interview. And I was surprised at how many times the name Larry Izzo came up. I figured we'd get a lot of, you know, talk about the Tim Ruddies, the Mark Dixons, guys that you play, you know, you were in the same room with, same huddle with. Izzo's on the other side of the ball, but you had some classic Larry Izzo stories, which I guess anybody who's played with Larry Izzo has some classic Larry Izzo stories. But it was almost like you opened up the journal and right away Larry was jumping off the page.
Yeah, well, for me, it was early on. You know, we did the training camp out in San Diego, and I know that's been talked about on the show numerous times, but it's that it was the eating challenge between him and Gray Rugemer that ensued. Because basically, we got there early, the rooms aren't ready. And so what you have is a room full of guys with a lot of money and nothing else to do. So somehow it gets floated that this food challenge comes up because there's the room is ready and set for dining, but we're not eating dinner for maybe another hour or so. But they got all the condiments out on the table. Everything's out there. And, you know, long story short, it comes down to like, you know, all right, this is going to be eat off between Larry Izzo and Gray Rugemer. And one guy, you know, Larry's got the mustard. Gray's got the mayonnaise, which is just sickens me even to think about. But this room, I couldn't believe, like, and it wasn't just them now. There was other challenges that came up after that and before that. There was things that happened, but that was the main, that was the lead on the docket there.
The main event.
One of the thoughts, I always remembered, it was like three and four people deep gathered around this table. Like everybody's in. I'm seeing side money changing hands. I'm seeing bets being thrown on the table. I mean, it's like $1,000 on the table for whoever wins it, which Larry did. I just think that he had the advantage, man, that whether you like him or not, that there's just more viscosity to that mustard. It could go down a lot smoother than that. I mean, it's just pure fat in that mayonnaise, you know. Sorry to Dukes and Hellman's and all those people out there, but damn, I mean, that's just nasty. And so they're going at it, and you know, Izzo ends up winning that thing. But you know, it's just another one of those instances. Like nothing like that had really happened to any team I was on with the Oilers, and it was one of those deals. Like coming to Miami was a little bit of a culture shock, and I think it probably was for Larry and some other guys on the team too, because I remember being in a locker room and hearing a story about Larry. He and Zach had gone down to Miami to do some kind of a coaching clinic. And it was really about special teams. And Zach Thomas was still fairly young in his career, so he did some things on special teams. So he'd take him down to this clinic, was paying him for that or whatever. But I think, you know, the story goes, and OJ can correct me, but they drove down in Westhoff's car, and he had a convertible. And so they go down there, they do this whole thing. And they're driving back, and they hit 95 traffic, and you know the air conditioner can't keep it cool enough. They're stop and go traffic, so he ends up, you know, taking the top down, getting it all the way down. Then they're so hot, like Larry, everybody took their shirts off, and so somebody spotted them on the highway, and they see the special teams coach and Larry and Zach all shirtless driving in a convertible coming back up the facility from down in South Beach somewhere. And it just, the stories just grew after that. And the hell that they got in the locker room was just unbelievable. It's just, that's the world I was thrown in from being, because the team moved from Houston to Nashville. Houston and Nashville can be very conservative towns, you know, and now it's no holds barred, man. Miami's, I mean, I'm like, what is going on? This is just this lifestyle. Every day I'm hearing something. Somebody's got a beach store. Listen, when I first moved down there, we had a brand new newborn. And I had a baby daughter. It was like 2.5. And so the best thing I could do was like, let me just keep the 2.5-year-old out of my wife's hair so they can get moved in. Her mom was there watching the newborn. So I'm like, just get time away. I didn't know anything about Miami. So I just, we've got a house out in Weston. We were like 3 gates away from Dan Marino. Cause like to get into country club, you got to go through a gate. And then if you wanted to go visit Dan, so I'm in that part, but then you have to go visit Dan. You got to go in another gate of like all the richest of the rich. Right. And then Dan had a gate at his property. Like he couldn't deal with the, you know, the guys that had $5-6 million homes. Like that's just the riffraff he had to keep out from his own neighborhood was just incredible. But I know nothing about it. So I just put my daughter in the car. It's like 9 a.m. I just drive straight west. And so I'm basically right in the heart of Fort Lauderdale. I'm right in that area, and the beach is empty. And I'm like, this is great. We'll just be out here playing. Don't have to worry about anything. And then slowly, you know, a couple hours go by, daughter's still doing strong. It's about 11 o'clock. And a lot of women start coming out on the beach. And I'm like, that's weird. You know, it's not weird. I'm looking around like, oh my gosh, look at this. This is unbelievable. And so then about 12 o'clock, I mean, it's just packed with mostly women out there. And, you know, they're half dressed. They're laying out, doing all this stuff. Luckily, my daughter doesn't know a thing. I'm just trying to keep focused straight ahead. Like, I'm happily married. I've been married 33 years. And I love my wife, and nothing was going to make me straight. Like, I'm good to go. I'm solid. But at the same time, I'm questioning what is going on here. So anyway, to make a long story short, I went back to the facility, and I'm like, gosh, you know, I'm just learning the area and all this stuff. And they're like, well, what beach did you go to? And I was like, I told them exactly where I was. And they're like, oh, my God, like, there's all these strip clubs all around there. And that's all the strippers. You know, they work at night. They sleep in about 11, 12 o'clock. They all go out to the beach. That's who's out there the whole time. And I'm like, I guess it makes sense. I had no idea. You guys got to help me out.
I guess it makes sense.
So I'm like, where's the family beach at? And everyone's struggling to figure it out because no one wants a family beach. Like, everybody's on the team. Like, it's big time now. Like, you're a dolphin. And it was a heyday now. You were a dolphin. You were big time. And these guys were finding the beach to go to because there was a lot of talent down there. So anyway, I chose poorly. I did fess up to my wife. I was like, you know, I'm sorry this happened. You might hear it because a locker room, you know, supposed to be sacred, but somebody's going to talk to somebody. Oh, yeah, your husband's the one that was down right. at the stripper beach.
With your two-year-old daughter, yeah. by the way.
Of course, she fit right in because she just had, like, bottoms on and a diaper, you know, or something. She's topless, too. So it's like, that's the norm.
She, oh, man.
Fit right in.
I don't even know where to go with it.
So she's in her mid-20s now, Kevin?
It's funny. She's a physician's assistant now, and she's working down in Charlotte, and she's great with it. I mean, she grew up with football. She's the oldest of my three kids. I have a son, two sons. One, they're 27, the daughter, 25 and 23. So it's, you know, it's great now to think back because I can remember, like, at training camp, I got a great picture with my son. He ran up to me right after practice, and I'm in full pads because it was great. But families were always welcome, you know, and OJ can attest, yeah. Seth, you know this. And so we're just giving each other a big kiss, and they got it in the Miami Herald. It was like on the front page. And I was like, man, this is awesome. You know, I got this keepsake to have with my son or whatever. But then, like the next day, Gogan replaces Donnelly at right guard. You know, it's just the headline in sports. And it was one of those things, you know, he was brought in really as security because Mark Dixon had gotten hurt a lot and had some neck injuries and groin and some different things. And when he was playing, he's a baller. He's the best guy on the offensive line probably, you know, him and Webby. But sometimes he just wasn't going to be there. So we need some assurance. We brought Gogan in. And so there was, you know, it made competition for the job tough, but it was just one of those deals. That's the business. Like one day, man, you can be on top of the world and you're just like, I'm on the team. I'm loving Miami. Got my son here, got a picture in the paper. And, you know, 2 days later, it's, you know, luckily they weren't that old. They'd be asking like, oh, daddy lost his job. What are we going to do? There's no food. We can't live anywhere.
Yeah, that's crazy, man. We're going to talk about Gogan a little bit, man. I want to go back to San Diego, though. I want to go back to Izzo, you know, because Izzo's always it's always a funny story. You know, I had a little run-in with Izzo, and we talked about it right here on the podcast. You know what I mean? Yeah. So, but I also understand that you had a little run-in with Izzo, too, out in San Diego. Well, getting ready for San Diego, yeah.
Well, there's a couple stories. Really, with Izzo, we were getting ready to play them in a regular season game against San Diego, and – he was in heaven because they basically just said, okay, Larry, you're on the scout team defense. You have carte blanche. Whatever you want to do, do it. That's what Junior Seau does. He picks in times. He's heady. He knows what's coming. Shoot through the B gap. Shoot through the A gap. Do whatever you got to do. And, I mean, Larry was in heaven. He channeled Seau for those three practices that week. It was probably the last padded practice. Like, I'm sick of it. I'm sick. He made the offensive line – our work that week was hell, and it's all Larry's fault. He's like, hey, I'm just doing my job, man. You know, I want to keep my job. I don't want to get cut. Like, I get that part of it. But in a fuel of rage, I'm blocking or whatever, and I see, oh, he's getting ready to come through this gap. He's going to try and embarrass us again. And really the best angle I had, the only thing I could really do to stop him, I just went, it's an unwritten rule. You don't do this in practice. You never do this, not to your own team. I went right for the kneecaps and cut him down. And I never felt better. I'm like, maybe a little twinge of guilt. I saw he was okay, but I got up. I'm like, yeah, take that, mother effer. So, but you know, it's that day wears on. You go back, you have lunch, you do your afternoon meetings, and I'm getting ready to head out to go home. And I can hear somebody screaming their ass off. They're just going to town, mad at somebody. I'm like, damn, somebody's about to get it. And then he comes walking down the hall and he spots me, and I see it's Larry. And he's like, damn, like when that happened, I thought you just tripped, man. I thought you just fell and I helped you up. And I was telling you, it's okay. Everybody, no one's hurt. It's all good. We're teammates. Everything's fine. You mother effer. He's like, that last word I heard was him mother effing me. I said, I'm done. This guy's got the eye of the tiger. He is zoned in right now. He is in for blood. He wants me. There's nothing I can do. I'm zoned out. I'm ready to go home and decompress. I ran to my car. I just bolted out those side security doors, ran to the car, jumped in, floored it, went home. Didn't really think about it. And we had some words about it the next day. He was okay with it because Larry's Larry. He understood. Like, that wasn't something he was going to, like, you do that to Timbo or Daryl Gardner, somebody like that. Now, you got another thing coming. You know, you better look.
You better run and not come back.
Eyes on the back of your head, you know, because it's coming. It might be a sneak attack. It might be full front. But whatever it is, you're going to get your due. Larry was good about it. He forgave me.
So, well, we can't talk about Izzo without also talking about the Dolphins' newest member of the Pro Football Hall of Fame. You mentioned him earlier, Zach Thomas. You know, if we're going to talk about this 99 season, the last game of that season took place January 2nd, 2000. So we had to make that transformation from 99 to 2000. Anybody who's old enough to remember, we know that that was Y2K hysteria.
Oh yeah.
So you have you have a great memory from you can tell, you know, we left early because the team, we were not going to get stuck in South Florida when the whole world shut down with Y2K. Mm-hmm. We had to get up to the DC area early.
Yeah, Y2K was big. Now looking back, it's funny, but I mean legit, people were really concerned. The markets were going to crash, computer systems down, just the end of civilization as we know it today. And
planes are going to crash, Kevin.
They're going to drop right out of the sky. You know, like, I mean, I tell you what, the world was coming to an end when New Year's Eve happened. The next morning you wake up and there's no record keeping whatsoever. And it's just like, we're going back to the dark ages. So there was enough legit info that it felt like, okay, we want to need to try and avoid anything we can. And in football, you just want to, it's so much unpredictable can happen during a game. You want to make sure that everything you can control, you control. So Jimmy Johnson had the idea, let's go up 2 days early since we're playing New Year's Day or the day after New Year's. So it's
played on the second.
Okay. Right. So let's go up 2 days early on that 31st. And then whatever happens for Y2K, we'll just live through it through the hotel. We're playing the Redskins/Commanders. We're up in Washington. So it's just unheard of. We leave 2 days early for an East Coast game. It's not like we're going out west, but we're up there. And so the first night, guys were going out. You know, we had a curfew. It was like 1 o'clock. Guys are going out. Not me. I'm the old dude, man. Like, I got to take care of my damn body. I think I rented Blair Witch Project or something like that in a hotel and said, because I'm scared as hell the rest of the night. So I did that to myself. But there's this huge commotion on my hallway right before curfew. It's like 12:50 or something, and it's yelling, there's banging, there's guys playing music, having a good old time. And the best recollection I got, it was like a group of DBs that had all gone out. There's probably some wide receivers with them. I know how y'all roll. I'm sure OJ was with
us. Never up, Kev. Never up.
So I'm kind of like interested, like, this interrupting my sleep. What's going on out here? And right when I opened my door, I looked down there, and they're raising hell. They're having a great time. They don't care about anything. Larry Izzo and Zach Thomas room together. They both come bursting out of their room, mad as hell. I mean, just what's going on? Complaining, bitching, keep it down. I'm trying to get my rest and all this stuff. But the thing was, it wasn't intimidating whatsoever. Nobody was even thinking about doing anything they wanted to do because they both came out in just their underwear. And and the way it looked and the way they stormed out in like these matching white briefs, you're like, everybody's laughing at him. Like, well, y'all sleeping together in there? You're in the same bed? You're tucked in? All this kind of stuff. And then finally, one of the guys said, man, it's just like a damn old married couple coming out of there, bitching at the DBs. I'm just, again, it's one of those things, like, I'd never been on a team like this, and it was just, there was so much personality to everybody. It just even made Y2K and the panic that was about to ensue. I'm like, this just happened here in a hotel. This is hilarious. I'm glad you brought it up, man, because it's, you know, Zach deserves that Hall of Fame, man. I always get guys asking me who should be in it, different writers that I've been associated with in Houston and Nashville and Miami and Charlotte, and they always give me these ballots to get my take, and he's been on there ever since he was eligible, because he was, what made him so great was his brilliance at the game. I mean, he knew what you were going to do before you even knew it, and but then he didn't know what was going on that night. He did not have any vision of that. He had not watched film on what was getting ready to go down in the hallway and how they basically punked him right in front of everybody, and they knew the story got told, you know, married couple. I mean, it just became their thing.
That had to make them even more mad, you know, that they came out there trying to be tough guys.
They thought they'd settle it down. All they did was fire them up even more until Brad Roll or somebody came around and did the bed check, all bowed up like he just did 18 cents a bench press.
Oh, my Too Lord. Funny.
All right. So a lot of talk of 1999, but since we went through Y2K, I'm going to bring us out of the 90s and let's get into the 2000s here, Kevin. And I'm sure all the young people listening to this are just cracking up. But we're going to fast forward right to Christmas Eve 2000. We're at New England. All right. It's about 30-something degrees. It's a 1 o'clock game, but it's like 30-something degrees because it is Christmas Eve. You know, another come-from-behind victory, or we think it is. Alindo hits his 49-yard field goal. There's 15 seconds left to play. You know, ball's kicked off, and Bledsoe's running around scrambling, trying to do some kind of crazy thing. Ball comes out, fumble, we recover it. We all march off the field celebratory, you know, in the locker room there. Dave is getting his thoughts together. Hey, and he's gathering everybody up, and he's about to give his speech, and he's like, hey, he's trying to get everybody's attention, and you know, that tiny little locker room. And then someone starts banging on the window, Kevin. Someone starts banging on the window. I look over, and it's the referee. It's Johnny Greer. And he's like, hey, you guys got to come back out here. Dave looked like he saw a ghost. Walk us through what the rest of you guys were thinking, and then the decision you made in that moment as we went back out on the field.
Oh, yeah. Listen, I think thinking about that, what started that is that locker room was so small, and the game got over. And it's freezing, and like I love the heat, man. I couldn't wait for a 105 degree game because those D linemen would melt. I mean, fourth quarter, it's like blocking dummies. When you go up in the cold, my skin had gotten thin, and I just, you know, we got the win, we played a good game. I'm heading right to a hot shower. That's all I could think about, right, man. Just get in, because there's probably like three of them. So I wanted to get in there, so I immediately start undressing, and so I'm pretty much totally undressed and got a towel around me. And basically that whole news goes down that we got to go back out on the field to finish up 1 second from the 50-yard line, whatever the play was. We got it was technically not over, and everyone has to come back out to the field. So I'm like, no, like somebody had to get me to go out there, because everyone had gone out there, and I'm thinking, well, I'll just, you know, hey, if there's, what's it matter if there's only 52 guys out there? You know, 53, 52, you know, I'm just going to hang in here.
Who's counting?
I'm getting ready to get in the shower, you know. But someone came through and was like, no, everybody has to get out. So I start saying, well, I'm not even dressed, and this. We better put something on. So I just threw my shoulder pads, I think, back on, or my jersey. And kept
a sweatshirt.
Towel.
You had like a blue sweatshirt.
A sweatshirt, okay. So I threw that on. I still had the towel around me. And then I threw on my cleats, untied, you know. So it's a bare minimum. And I didn't – they said get on the field. So I didn't go to our sideline. I just stood there in the tunnel and waited for that last play to go through. And, you know, looking back now, I'm like, that's just pure insanity. But I just, in that moment, I'm just like, I don't know. I just bowed up. I said, no, man, this is not fair. This game should be over by now. And I got to get redressed. My gear's all sweaty. I'm not doing it. I refused. I was being like a little stubborn 3-year-old, you know, no. But luckily, no fines from the NFL. I don't think I even heard anything from coach about it, anything like that. But I think back, you know, we finished this game. The whole team's on that one sideline. Luckily, most of the attention was the defense, because they're the ones that had to get back out there. So they were right. The ones that were truly, truly pissed off. And so, you know, as mad as I thought I was, they were the ones that were, you know, I did feel sorry for later on having to do that. But luckily, we got that win. But at that picture, if you can imagine, yeah, just a blue Dolphin sweatshirt, towel wrapped around me, couple of muddy cleats on my feet, just standing with my hands on my hips, probably just watching out there. And I was like, let's just get it over and get it done.
Oh, man.
30-something degrees, and all he had was that towel, Juice.
That was so funny. I remember that, man. I was fully dressed already at that point, you know? And I really, sometimes, you know, I listen to Juan's. I start getting, you know, getting ready, getting in the shower while Juan's talking, you know?
Especially after a win, right? After a win, it's lighter anyway. Let's just, hey, let's get in, say our stuff, get on the plane.
Much lighter, man. Much lighter, man. You know, there's another game, you know, that season I want to talk about, Kevin. It's the open round of the playoffs in that year. And we're hosting the Colts, a game that we talked about the other day with another guest we had, which was blacked out locally, by the way. We didn't sell enough tickets for it, man. But we've talked about this game a lot on a lot of our episodes, especially what Lamar Smith had done. You know, and he had an incredible performance, ending with that 17-yard touchdown run in overtime, you know, to send us into the next round of playoffs. But Lamar was grinding all game, man. You talked a little bit about playing with, you know, Warren Moon and having to pass block all the time. You had Natron Means in college, you know, where it was probably a lot better for you. But this game here, Lamar had 40 carries for, you know, 209 yards. You know, the 40 carries, that means that you guys were getting it done, man. You guys were doing all that work up front, man. So what do you remember about that day and that game?
Well, I'm sure it was probably a beautiful day just to start with. But when it's 85 or 80 degrees still, even though it's into January there, right?
Yeah.
So it's still warm. So you're going to wear some defensive linemen out. So when we got that running game going early, we stuck with it. We had a power running game. I know it probably wasn't a fun day for you, but man, that's when you really get in the flow and you really start to be able to tire those guys out, you know, make them want to give up in the fourth quarter. And it was still touch and go, obviously, with an overtime game, but it's one of my favorite games because of the way, you know, Lamar, I mean, he was physical. He could run. He was just did a brilliant job of what we asked him to do. And I had two games where there's been walk-off touchdowns and overtime games. And so those are the most fun because that was the first one, just thinking, let's get in field goal position. Let's get in field goal position and, you know, send a kicker out there. Let's get this thing done and move on to the next round. You know, and that's all you really want. And for it to happen, at the time, my first take was it's almost a shock. Like, we just won the game. And I really think I was trying to figure out my notes and everything that I kept, but I think this is the game. Like everybody comes running off the sideline because, you know, it wasn't like a field goal situation. You know, you're going to celebrate the kicker, but when a guy runs for one and closes the game out and it's a walk-off deal, like game over, everybody's running off the sideline. It goes back to Izzo. Like I was so fired up about it and I was blocking dudes all day long. Like I just went full hit to the chest on Larry. Like he's trying to give me a hug and like, I don't know why I did it, but then I just kept celebrating with Trace Armstrong and, you know, whoever would come around, you know, was coming off the sideline. Cause like we were the heroes, man. The defense didn't have to go back out there. We won the game. It's as much love as you're going to get from all the other guys on the sideline. That was fun. But I can remember the next day, Larry's like, bro, like, why'd you hit me, man? Like that really hurt, you know, like that messed me up. I didn't know, like, had I done something wrong before? Like, cause he's real, he cares like that. Basically I had to tell him like, no, I just did that out of joy, man. Sorry. Like, man, kind of ruined my celebration, man. I'm sorry. You know, I apologize. Like I said, man, those are special when you get the walk off. It's not just settling for a field goal and hoping that everything executed right and you get that game won.
So true, man. And by the way, now I went to Penn State. Now I don't mind blocking for some touchdowns now, Kev.
No,
you know what I mean? We did a lot.
No, and listen, what I loved about that particular year, I know you guys were doing your jobs, and the best receivers that hang around the longest, these guys were affected the block. You know, we were transitioning from, you know, Dan was getting later in his career, and we had to really depend on the run game. And it's a 5-yard or 7-yard gain turns into a big-time play or even a touchdown when the receivers do their job. I think my appreciation for that, you know, when you're early in your career, you're just fighting for you. Like, just don't get beat. Just do your job. And then you start to see the aspect of your group. You know, okay, the offensive line, I want to do well as a group. Or with Juice, you know, the wide receivers do well as a group. And then you start to see the offense and the bigger picture and how everybody plays an integral role, whether it's a pass, a run. Heck, you got to be on point for a kneel down play, the best play in football, right? The victory formation. Right. get it right, line up right.
That's right, man.
But yeah, definitely. No, I know. Shoot, Mike Munchak, the Hall of Famer I mentioned, was from Penn State, and that's a different breed when you go to that school now. There's a certain amount of toughness.
Well, Kevin, that last story is the perfect segue to our final segment of the show, which is the Fish Tank 2-Minute Drill. Much like the story you told at the beginning of the show, we're changing the play. You don't know what the protection is.
Oh,
that's
God.
Okay. I think you're going to figure it out.
All right.
Not to make you nervous at all, but this is our fast-paced 2-minute drill.
Video. Like I just looked at my, like I have a full head in the camera here. Like if you play this video, people are going to know what I had for breakfast. It's stuck in my teeth here.
Don't worry. What it actually looks like when the guys get it for video, it's zoomed out more. Okay. This is just so you can see it on the screen.
I
can't do anything about your head, but the camera angle will be a little bit better.
That's the thing I learned, man. When I lost 60 pounds after I stopped playing football, and you don't lose it in your head. Like, it just becomes bigger and bigger, man.
That thing ain't getting any smaller.
No, my feet, my head, man. I wear 16 still, and I've got this big ass head.
Well, we'll see if that big ass head can get you through this 2-minute drill.
All right, go.
So we're gonna throw some questions at you. All right. So Kevin, the modern NFL loves analytics. But when you were with the Dolphins, we had one player who loved complex math problems more than anyone else. And he was a big guy, and he was on the other side of the line. Darryl Gardner.
Yeah, that dude, every time – we got 2 minutes here, so I'll tell it quick. This guy, every time I pass him in the locker room, I'm like, Darryl, man, you look like you're fired up for this game. You know what? I wear a size 16 shoe. I weighed in at 310 today, and I had soup for breakfast. You do the math. You do the math and tell me if I'm going to win this game today.
I love it.
Do the math.
I know OJ's heard that, for sure.
Do the math. Make sure you carry the one. Yeah. Make sure you carry the one.
No, dude. Yeah. Hey, you know what? Gave my wife a kiss on the right cheek instead of the left cheek, and then I saw the sunrise this morning. Plus, you divide that by one, do the math, and Kevin, you're getting 2 sacks out of me today. All right, I did the math. Thanks, Darryl.
All right, okay, Kevin. All right, you love the good joke in the locker room, but who laughs harder at everyone else's jokes, Tim Bowens or Richmond Webb?
That's dead equal to me. Both those guys now, like Richmond and Tim, they get the hand up near the mouth, and they're just laughing quietly, and it's that's the quiet cosign of whatever joke's going on. They're going to laugh so hard. Like, there's times when stuff wasn't even funny. Like, if it was about me, my locker was right next to Ruddy and Richmond Webb, and I'm sitting there, and the joke's not even funny, and it's being played on me. And those two, especially Webb, he's just laughing and laughing, trying to keep the thing going the whole time. Like, it's the funniest joke he's ever heard in his life. I call him out on it. He's like, no, I'm not trying to do that. And Tim, like, I could hear him. This was the next locker over. Like, I'd never really heard him talk a whole lot. But, man, that dude had a laugh, and you knew someone was getting slammed on that other side of the locker. Somebody's getting put down because he was laughing it up.
So it's a push. It sounds like it's a push, Juice. All right, next question. And I hope I don't ruin our friendship over this one since we just got reconnected here.
Yeah.
Your fellow lineman had an interesting nickname for you that I never understood. Tell us the history of Doink.
All right, Doink, it started, I think, with Larry Bechtel when I was with the Houston Oilers. And so then I thought it was dead after he had left. People with the Oilers still called me Doink, but I thought, you know, all right, I'm leaving for another team. I'm going to play in South Beach and be a part of this Dolphins franchise, and I'm going to leave that behind. But unfortunately, Bechtel, you know, was there and brought that whole thing up again. But basically, I'd do whatever it took to win a play. And this was during an era where, like, picking DBs off that were near a pile. Like, that's cool, man. That's cool. Like, no flags for that. You know, you got caught standing around, you're going to get got. You know, and I got too, but I like to get mine. And so they're like, dang, like, you're mean, man. Like, you like evil jokes on people. You're not nice at all. You do all this stuff that's mean. So then suddenly Bechtel, I never knew this character. And I watched wrestling growing up. I was a big fan of WWF wrestling at the time, WWE. And there was a character named Doink, the evil clown. And so he was the clown that would – he'd come out there, and regular clown has got a big bucket of water, and he's going to throw it on the little kids in the front row. But it's like regular clowns, they do it, it's just full of confetti. Oh, it was funny. It was such a surprise. But like Doink, the killer clown there, he like it was real water, and there's like kids crying on the front row, and it's like he was just mean. And so Bechtel starts saying that you're just a mean football player. Like, you got something personal against everybody on the field. And it's like, well, that's the way I got to play. You know, I needed an edge. every single game. And, you know, to me, it was, there was nothing more fun than picking guys off a linebacker trying to get an extra hit on a running back, or especially a wide receiver. Because, listen, there's a lot of things, like I was not the most athletic guy or best 40 or best vertical jump and all that. But I tell you what, I could run. And I my conditioning was for days. But, damn, that gave me that extra conditioning I need, that I'd go hunt guys up downfield. And I'd see some DB trying to lay out a wide receiver or something like that. It's just, I knew guys were gunning for me, but I was like, I didn't care. All I cared about was that moment, you know, and NFL wasn't fining a lot of times. In fact, during that era, I had one fine, and it was because, like, there was a DB in Washington, Chris Dishman. We ran a quarterback sneak, and he jumped on late to hit Steve McNair. And so the play's clearly over, but I'm so pissed that he tried to do that. Like, I went full karate kick to the face mask of Dishman.
Oh, damn.
And I can remember getting in front of the guy in charge of fines for the league, and I'm pleading my case, you know, and he's listening and nodding and the whole deal, you know, like $5,000, man. It was like self-defense. Like, he came in there trying to hurt me, and I just was trying to get him off me. I wasn't trying to kick. And, well, those are good words, Kevin, but, you know, the fine sticks. And then click, hung up the phone, you know, and I was just like, I never got one after that, but it taught me that I played in the right era. I couldn't play now. The game is fantastic. I'd love to say I could go out there and still ball if I was in shape, even if I was in my prime. But what kept me in the game around was a lot of offensive line coaches just liking what I was doing downfield. It just added some toughness and nastiness to it.
The evil clown. Yeah. Who knew?
Love Doink. It. Love it.
Oh, it's Beck. Tough, Doink. Look at your steps there, old Doink. Come on, Doink.
Doink followed you just like that fight song is what it sounds like. Yeah.
Yes. Right. Yes, Beck.
Oh, man, good times.
That's so damn good, Kevin.
Good times.
That's so
good. Well, that's a two-minute drill in about 9.5 minutes. There's a reason Dan Marino called off the play and told you to figure shit out.
Yeah, because the game would have been over. We lose the game because I'm asking what the damn protection is. I'm getting booted off the team then, too.
Hey, I'm glad, man, you didn't still boot
me off.
10.
You didn't boot me off, man. I needed my time, and I needed to think about it, and you gave me that time. So thank you for the freedom.
Absolutely. We can play with space and time in here. That's the good thing about it. Kevin, this was a blast, man. God, this was fun. Like, this was really great.
So good, yeah. Kevin. Yeah. So
no,
good,
I appreciate y'all. This y'all have fun on all these things, and I was excited to be asked to be on it, man. And I never thought that I'd get to visit with Juice again and Seth. And man, that's you do a really good job, man. It's really stirred up a lot of feelings in me that I, you know, just thinking back to how special those days were. You're lucky if you can play one down in the NFL. I mean, that's how hard it is. And when you're in that moment and you're putting a career together, and, you know, you don't think about it till the very end, or you're maybe 5-10 years retired of like, man, I really did something special. Like, so many guys try to get there and just play, you know, one snap or one game or one season, or let me put 2 or 3 seasons together. And there's thousands of guys that would love to be in that position, and only a few get to do it. And then to last, you know, especially as long as OJ and myself and other guys that we talked about, like Richard Webb and Dan Marino, it really was a blessing. So I appreciate you guys letting me open up and share some stories and just run on, man. You let me talk, and I appreciate it.
Oh, now that we know you have the journals, you might need to come back, yeah. Juice. We might have to repeat part two here.
We didn't really cover 98 very much. I got some gold from there. And
yeah, we'll get you back in for sure.
No, okay, because I don't know if this is – I got some great John Bach ones.
Oh, go ahead. Go into the books. Give us the best thing
we're
you got.
Definitely getting back. So he's definitely
this
coming
is
back.
One that stuck out to me. So I'm not sure what season it was or which offensive line. I think it was Paul Boudreaux with the offensive line coach. So it was probably 99 season. And, you know, we'd been playing, and maybe it was a time when the offensive line wasn't playing quite as good during the season sometime. And so Boudreaux said, you know what, we're going to watch this game film. I've graded it, but I want each of you to grade your own play sheet as we're going through this. And John Bach played the entire game. And so basically you had to put a plus or a minus down. Like, you didn't want a bunch of fluff, like explanations, comments, just, did you do your job or did you not? I don't care about the technique, whatever. Did you know what to do and did you get it done? Plus. If you didn't, minus. So I come up with this idea, like at the same time I'm grading myself, but I created a sheet that would be a box sheet. And every play, I put a plus next to it. But even with the notes that we made about the game on this sheet that we were going to turn into Coach Boudreaux right when the meeting was over, I had written down a bunch of stuff on there about how, hey, Coach, look, I pass blocked this guy all day long. He never got by me. Hey, Coach, take a special look at this play. I think you're going to see it's a domination block. Put me down for one domination block. More to come. So it was just over the top. And he didn't want those comments. But the slickest part about it was, I'm like, okay, everybody, stand up your sheets here so I can give him the boo. Stand your boo. So I grab his sheet, take his out, and put that fake one in, gave him the boo. The very next meeting we have, Boo is like, guys, I got to share something with you. You know, grading the game, and there's one particular player that really had an outstanding game, and I'm going to share with you some comments that he made to me. So he starts sharing all this stuff, and Bach's like, what the fuck, you know, what's going on? This is, I didn't do this, whatever. He's confused. And we're all just laughing, and Webb's, you know, this whole thing's going on. Anyway, we never cracked. Boo for sure thought it was either me or Gogan or Webb. He's like, one of you three, maybe even Ruddy. He's like, only you guys could have masterminded this. Like, somehow this happened. I know this is BS or whatever. And we all had a really big laugh out of it. But to see him on the spot for about 5 minutes there while he's going through the sheet, it was unbelievable.
I'm going to tell you this, Kevin, man. O-line had the best time, yeah, man. I think the personality, O-line, and I think D-line, man. I mean, those personalities are second to none, yeah, bro.
No, this was fun, man.
This was spectacular. I think better than anybody could have expected, man. So we definitely got to get you back on, and really appreciate you spending some time.
I loved it. I had a great time, guys. I really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for diving in, Kevin.
Be well, man. Stay good.
You're now diving into the fish tank.
Just like Drew said, thanks for diving into the Fish Tank presented by iHeartRadio. Be sure to follow us on whatever streaming platform you're using, and don't be afraid to rate the show or leave us a comment. We love your feedback. And remember, you can find us as well as Drive Time with Travis Wingfield and all of our international partners on MiamiDolphins.com.